You're listening to the New Community Podcast of Palm Valley Church. We hope that this message encourages you in your walk with Christ.
So the last several weeks, we've been in the book of Daniel. Tonight, we're going to conclude our series in Daniel. We've been looking at the first six chapters. The first six chapters of Daniel is more of a narrative telling of the Hebrews, and it focuses primarily on four people: Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are their Babylonian names, but they're Hebrew boys, and a guy by the name of Daniel. The book of Daniel continues, and it moves really from narrative to prophecy, and so we'll perhaps tackle that at another time. But for this series, we wanted to look just at the first six chapters and really wrestle with what does it look like to live in Babylon. So in 605 BC, Babylonian Empire, led by the guy by the name of Nebuchadnezzar, marched to the west to a city called Carchemish, and there he took down the world rulers of that day, of that time, the Assyrians. He chased the Egyptians, who had aligned themselves with the Assyrians, all the way back down to Egypt. And on the way back home, on the way back to Babylon, he stopped off in Israel to pay all the Israelites a visit, just so they would know who the new chief in town is, who the new sheriff was, so to speak, made his way to Jerusalem, and just as maybe a little collateral to make sure that they would abide by the new rules, he took their brightest and their youngest, some of the nobles, some of the royals, some of the people that were upper echelon. He took their boys. He took the smart ones. He took the handsome ones. He took the ones that you're like, I hope we get them back. And he said, just to make sure things go well with you, they're with me. And you get any bright ideas, I might get a few of my own with all of your sons. So he takes Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with upwards to 10,000 others, and they track them 500 miles to a place called Babylon. And over the next 20 years, really climaxing at 586 BC, where he comes in, he says, I've had enough with you. He just pummels the city, destroys the walls, takes down the temple. And other than the poorest of the poor and the farmers, King Nebuchadnezzar takes all of the Hebrew people and he deports them to Babylon, where they will live the next 70 years as exiles. This is where the book of Daniel picks up. So chapter 1 sets the stage. You've got these four Hebrews. They're now in Babylon. They're in the university. They're enrolled in the school. And yet we see in chapter 1 that they distinguish themselves from everyone else. Chapter 1, verse 8, it says, they resolve, they purpose in their heart not to defile themselves. They're in the world, they're in the school, they're in the classroom, they're in the culture, and yet, even there, they're distinguished, they're distinct, they are set apart to God. Chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, it puzzles him, he doesn't know what to do, he calls all the enchanters of the kingdom together, nobody can interpret it, finally Daniel steps forward, he interprets it, it's the dream of a statue, a 90-foot statue, the top is gold, the rest of it is three different types of metal, and it represented four kingdoms. Chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, I'm not really interested in the other three kingdoms. I think the whole statue should be about me, and I think the whole thing should be gold because I was the head, and the head was gold. I want the whole thing gold. In fact, let's up the ante a little more. I think everyone in the known world should bow down to me when the music plays. Three of them refused to. There were probably more, but the story focuses on three. Continues on, chapter 4, there's a decree in all the land, but we'll get to that. So chapter 3, he builds this 90-foot statue. And on the inaugural day, it gives the idea that there's the princes, there's the nobles, there's the leaders, but then they send letters almost out to all the neighboring communities and says, everybody needs to come to the stadium, if you will. They all gather in one place, just picture NFL football stadium. Visualize Super Bowl Sunday. There could be 20,000 people, but there could be upwards to 150,000 people there. Nobody knows what's going on. They're just told to come. The plan is that there's a band, there's music. When the music starts playing, everyone's going to be told, get on your face and bow. And if you refuse to bow, you'll be thrown into the fire and you'll die. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it seems, weren't a part of the planning committee. They left them out. And they planned this thing. And you just have to imagine, you've got these three Hebrews, and we don't know how old they are. They could be 14. They could be 15. They're teenagers. They're high school freshmen, perhaps, at best. They're in section 121, row H, seat 19, 20, 21. There's music, or there's not the music, but there's this crowd, and there's this roar, and then the music starts, and before it starts, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're like, what's going on? What's going on? And some guy, like, sitting in seat 18 is like, psst, be quiet. The music's going to start. And when the music starts, you got to get down and bow, and if you don't bow, they're going to kill you. You mean like bow and worship? Yeah, bow and worship. When the music starts, you bow. If not, they're going to kill you. Be quiet. I think it's getting ready to start. And the music starts. And they stand. And yet, you have to picture, you ever been to a football game? You ever just watched the Super Bowl? Right? You've got thousands upon thousands of people. All the colors are blending in. You can't tell who's sitting, who's standing, unless the guy in front of you is standing and you're sitting, and, you know, then a fight breaks out like it typically does. And you got Nebuchadnezzar way down, right, where like whoever's getting ready to perform performs. It's the main event. You've got this statue. There's no cameras. There's no Jumbotron. There's no HD LED screen, but all eyes are down in the center. Neb's there somewhere close by. The music starts, and who can see, like, way up in the nosebleed seats? Hey, there's three guys. Looks like section 121, row G, seat 19, 20, 21. Neb, there's three guys. Nobody, Neb doesn't have a clue. There's no way he can see who's standing and sitting unless someone's watching. Unless someone is in section 121, near row G, who'd follow in the guys that are going to sit in seat 19, 20, and 21. And they go down, and they just simply say, O king, there are some Hebrews that aren't not sitting. I don't know what it would have been like, but you're the three guys. You show up. You're trying to figure out what's going on. I'll tell you where I want to be. I want to be in section 121, row H, seat 20, leaning in right when the guy in row in front of me tells them. No, it doesn't tell us that there's sections or rows. I'm just visualizing. This is how I read the Bible. Just stupid. I want to be the guy sitting right behind them, and they're like, what's going on? They said, we got to bow or die. What are they going to do? And you have to imagine, they'd have been like, hey, all right, here's how this is going to go down. When the music starts, let's just bow, right? Let's start it. Here we go. Say this after me. God, we bow to you, you alone. We know there's that ugly, dumb statue, and King Nebuchadnezzar thinks he's the big kahuna, but God, he's not even big cheese. He just smells like cheese. God, we're bowing on the outside, but on the inside, we're standing up for you. It's all about you. It's all about you, Jesus. We're all about you. Well, it's not really Jesus, but Jesus, we know you're coming. It's all about you. See, that wasn't so bad. We got through this. They could have done that. They could have just went through the motions. We're just going through the motions. I didn't mean it in my heart. God bless you. You know, but here's a principle I think we need to pay attention to. The moment we set ourselves apart, the moment we make a decision that I'm going to stand for righteousness, the moment we make a decision that I'm going to become a Christ follower, the moment we make a decision I'm going to follow God, there's somebody in close proximity to you that's going to start watching. That's going to start listening. And it's going to start looking for an opportunity to say, so you're with your coworkers, and that guy that always tells that joke breaks out one of those jokes, and you're like, and then one of the other guys says, wait, what are you laughing at? I thought you were a Christian. They're having a little skizzy, and then you jump in, you get caught up, and you say something like they're saying something, and one of them's like, I thought you were a Christian. Like, well, I am, but I just got... You're at family at Thanksgiving, and there's that uncle and that other uncle. He's Democrat. He's Republican. They're both too political for their own good. And they just start. Do you have uncles like that? Right? They start talking. Everybody's like, hey, let's go play in the street. Kids, go play in the street because it's about to blow up. You know, and they're talking. And you used to get in there, but, you know, you Jesus in your heart now. But yet you get a little riled up, and you get in there, and then they're like, stop judging us. You Christians, you're always judging us. You get in there. You say something like you used to say something. It's like, oh, look at you. I thought you were a believer. And inside, you're like, oh, I'm a believer. I'm a believer in the Holy Trinity. I'm about to introduce you to the Father and the Son, right? That's what you want to say, but you're like, and the moral of the story is not keep your mouth shut. That's not the moral of the story. The moral of the story is when you make a decision, people start watching. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had somehow set themselves apart, and it was known. They're not just like, I'm standing up for Jesus on the inside and I'm bowing down on the outside. No, people knew. No, they weren't obnoxious about it, but people knew. And they're watching and they're waiting. And as soon as they stand and keep standing, O King. I don't know if you noticed, but those guys aren't, they're still standing. When we choose to make a stand, there's others that are watching. And they'd love nothing more than for us to blow it. And it just simply says, they stand, they keep standing. They're not just standing on the outside, they're standing on the outside and the inside. And they choose to follow. And yet, you know, if I'm like Shadrach, I'm thinking, music starts. Hey, Meshach, look, there's some pennies on the floor. Let's get them. Help me pick them up. Oh, was that the music playing? I didn't even notice. I was just trying to get me some shekels, you know? Or, you're like Meshach, and you're like, guys, check it out. I got these new sandals, but I got these pebbles. Oh, music starts. Let me get these pebbles out of my toes, you know? And you try to, like, you blame it on the sandal pebble, but it's because of music. Oh, was that the music? And then you're like, you know, you're that other guy, and you got this big old fro, and, you know, your name's Big Old Fro. Abednego, you'll get it later. And, you know, he's messing with him hair or something. I don't know. And the world would say, Babylon would say, just bow. It's no big deal. He'll get over it. Nah, you know, he has these phases. He gets in, he gets out. Just bow. It'll be all right. But no, I don't think we want to. You could get promoted if you bow. You could get more money if you bow. You could get a better position if you bow. You know, if you don't bow, they're not going to like you. And it's the same echoes that we could hear in our own workspaces in today. It's like, if you want to get up and to the right, then you do this, you do that, you do this, and yet they simply choose to set themselves apart. And they're thrown into the fire. But yet they don't die. And then chapter 6, you've got a similar type thing. There's a new king in town. His name's Darius. Darius has a new ruling policy that he wants to rule all the people, but he realizes, I need to spread out the love a little bit, the power. And so he appoints 120 satraps, they're little governors that each have a little area. And then over those 120 satraps, he put 3 administrators, one of which is Daniel. And then over the 3 administrators, he puts Daniel on top. And we talked about this last week with just the ploys and the traps of envy. And so the satraps and the administrators have a little meeting after the meeting once Daniel leaves, and they're like, we got to take that boy down. I've had enough of that. And so they come up with this plan. Hey, King Darius, we think everybody should pray to you and you alone for 30 days because we know he won't pray because we've been watching what he does. Darius says, great idea. Sounds good. Be a good little publicity campaign for us for the next 30 days. Maybe boost the morale of the people. Everybody bows down, prays to me. And so they're praying, right? And I love what verse 10 says about Daniel. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. 3 times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help, and then they went to the king and snitched. Here's what we know about Daniel. He lives in Babylon. He lives in a house. The house that he lives in has at least 2 floors, and his bedroom is in the 2nd floor. He's got a window, and the window faces toward Jerusalem. We don't know exactly where Daniel's house was in the city, and we don't know exactly what Daniel's house looked like, but they've excavated Babylon. They found the walls. They have pieces of the walls. Some are in Berlin, in the Pergamon Museum. The other pieces of the walls, a lot of them are in Istanbul, Turkey. We've actually, some of our teams, when we go to Turkey and Greece, we've walked in there, and you stand in front of these walls, and you're just like, these are 2,500 years old. I just want to touch it. It's amazing. And then they've got this replica of the gate, of the Ishtar Gate, and it's huge. It's huge. They've excavated this. You can walk and see walls. You can see what they believe was the royal palace of Nebuchadnezzar. And they found houses. Let me show you an artist's rendering of what would be a wealthy family compound, believed in the time that Daniel would have been there. So in the Middle East, now this is a larger house. I don't know that Daniel's house is quite this big. But what was common on the larger ones and the small ones is that they often had 2 floors. And on the top floor, there was at least one window. And the window wasn't to let light in. It was a little, but they weren't big. They were small. We're not talking these big verandas with double arch windows. And now, Neb probably had one of those, Nebuchadnezzar. But Daniel, there's these little windows. They let a little light in, but they're more for ventilation. They're usually up high. They're not down low. Daniel's in a house. His room's on the second floor. And it says he gets down on his knees and he prays. The question is, to see Daniel praying, where might you have to be? You're not just walking by the street and looking up into the second floor down. You got to know where Daniel lives, and you want to position yourself across the street, probably on the third floor or on top of your second floor, looking down into the window. There he is. He's praying. Go tell the king. They're spying on the dude. Because when you make a bold stance, people start watching. But I love what Daniel does. He doesn't run to the king and pound his fist and say, I'm not going to bow, I'm not going to pray. But on the same token, he doesn't close his window and pray in a corner. He does what he's always done. And I love the power of verse 10 because it gives us a glimpse into what actually enabled Daniel and his friends to withstand the forces of Babylon. It says he went to his room. The window was facing Jerusalem. He got down and he did it 3 times a day, and it's believed that he did it at 9 a.m., 12 p.m., and 3 p.m., because that's some of the set times that the Jews had for prayer, even at the time of Jesus. We don't know exactly the time, but there were 3 designated times that in verse 8 of chapter 1, it says, we've purposed in our heart not to defile ourselves. There's other spiritual practices and habits or patterns and routines in life that they said, this is who we are and this is what we do. And it wasn't like this crisis came about, oh my goodness, I got to pray or I'm going to die. No, he didn't pray because there was a crisis. He prayed because he always prays. And on this particular day, there was a crisis. Many of us, it takes a crisis to catapult us into prayer, and it's good that it does, and it should. But I've noticed that the people that withstand the storms of life, as we sang about earlier, they're the people that don't just call out when the storm comes. They're the people that they've been calling out when the storm wasn't even there. And Daniel, it just says he prayed 3 times a day, 3 times a day, 3 times a day. And the decree of Darius doesn't change that. It doesn't increase that. It doesn't diminish that. He still does what he's always done. And yet, I think we live in a world. Facebook's great. If you're my friend, love you. If you're not my friend, you know, friend me, I don't care. But I think what I see often is when something like this happens, we're a whole lot more quick to take up Facebook than we are to take up fasting. We're a whole lot more quicker to protest and picket, and there's a place for that, but often we do that prior and exempt from praying. And what Daniel displays, that there is a place for character, there is a place for living outwardly, but the power, the furnace, is what you do by yourself in private. It was what Daniel did in private in prayer that enabled him to do in public in front of everyone. It's what he did in private that enabled him to have strength in public. And so they find out and they throw him into the lion's den and he gets saved. And our kids, if you have kids that have grown up in church, they know these stories. They know about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're thrown into the fire, woo, you know, and they didn't get burned. And Daniel gets thrown into the lions and woo, he didn't get eaten. Of course, we don't tell the rest of the part. There's 22 other people that got thrown into the lion's den with their wives and kids, and all of them got eaten. We leave that part out of the kids' book. But we love these stories because God saved the day. But if we read through Scripture, we'll see that there's dozens of other people that were in very similar situations, and God could have saved the day, but he let their blood spill. There were 12 apostles after Jesus rose from the dead, and all but one, God let their blood spill. All but John, the apostle, it's believed, was killed a martyr's death for their faith. And Daniel, he didn't flaunt it, but he didn't hide it. He just lived on mission. God saved him, but you've got the other 11 apostles, and they died. You've got these waves in the first century, in the second century, in the third century, all the way up until just before Constantine became emperor and Christianity became normalized. You've got these waves of persecution. And one church father by the name of Tertullian says, they keep killing so many Christians because they're trying to, like, kill this movement. But it's as if the blood of the Christians, the blood of the martyrs, it becomes the seedbed of the church. And they kill one, and they just spring up more. It's we see it in our own day in China, where you outlaw Christian, and you outlaw sharing the gospel. And so they go underground. And the more they try to legalize you can't be a Christian, the more Christians spread the word about what it means to follow Jesus. And it explodes. It's unknown to most of us because you woke up, you got your coffee, you put on what you wanted to wear, we drove to our place of employment, if that's our reality. You might have said a prayer in the break room before you ate. Nobody was checking at the door to see if we had Bibles on us. I mean, we're free. But since Jesus rose from the dead, 90 million people, their blood have spilled because of Jesus. 2016 alone, 100,000 Christians lost their life. From the time you walked into this room to the time you leave this room, 12 people will have been killed for Jesus. Not 12 obnoxious picketers, just 12 people living their life for Jesus but refuse to bow to Babylon. Every 5 minutes in the world in which we live, someone dies. Because when you make a claim to follow Jesus, someone begins watching, and at times it means you lose everything. So the official says to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you can bow or you can be thrown into the fire. And they step forward and they say, the God whom we serve, he's able to save us. But even if he doesn't, we're still not bowing. Darius said to Daniel, I hope you pray that the God whom you serve can save you. But Daniel, in his heart, I think still would say, I'd rather be eaten than not talk to him. Lock me up. They're in Babylon. How do they live? People either go to the extremes, like we need to be obnoxious. Others say, let's just love Jesus on the inside, make it personal, just between me and him. I don't really talk about it. It's kind of personal. I don't like talking about my faith. That sounds holy and noble, but usually it just means I'm scared. The prophet Jeremiah, who had already warned these people in Jeremiah 25, Nebuchadnezzar's going to come if you don't repent. And they blew it off and said, do what we want. And Nebuchadnezzar came and took them away. And Jeremiah the prophet, the mouthpiece of God, writes these words to those people, captives, slaves, prisoners, people whose moms and dads, in some cases, were no longer with them. And this is his instructions. He's telling them, here's how you are now to live there. Jeremiah 29, verse 4, he says, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. I'm supposed to pray for Babylon. Like this city that represents evil, this city that represents corruption, this city that killed my mom and my dad and ripped me away, this city, I'm supposed to pray for? How about I pray for Jerusalem? But Jeremiah says, no, settle down. Not like, settle down, like, settle down. Build a house, plant a garden, go find a wife for your son, build a picket fence, and get ready for grandchildren. And there's these other prophets that Jeremiah talked about. They come up and say, guys, God spoke to me and he said, hallelujah, you're going to get out of here soon. You're in Babylon, but only for a short time. You're going to get out, you're going to go home. And Jeremiah said, shut up, you're lying. That wasn't God. You're not getting out of here. You're going to be here 70 years. Build a house, plant a garden, pray for the city. Don't be angry. Don't be malicious. Don't walk around. Repent and bless. And yet people are like, well, we just want to pull away and have our own little mini Jerusalem inside Babylon, and God will come and take us away. And Jeremiah said, no, you're there. You're going to be there a while. So why don't you spread the love? And sometimes Christians, we pull away in our corners and we got Christian t-shirts and Christian bumper stickers and Christian music and all that's good. But we sometimes may do so at the point of isolating ourselves from Babylon. And some Christians, when you hear them talk, they say, one day the Lord is coming back. He's going to take us home. And hell's going, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But he's going to come and set us free. It's getting worse and going to get worse. We're going to go up there. And I think Jeremiah would say to us, shut up. You're here. And you may be here a while. So build a house, plant a garden, get about mission, in mission, and be the light to the world, be the salt to the world, and do what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say, pray this kingdom go up there. No, pray, God, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Someday Jesus will come back. Someday Jesus will take us away. Someday it'll all go away. But until then, he says, don't wait, like, come now, come quickly. I'm going to hold off in the corner until you get here. He says, I may come, and you can pray I come quickly. But until then, build a house, plant a garden, go out into the streets, and be the light, and be the salt, and pray your kingdom come on earth, in my mind, in my heart, in my family, in my marriage, in my kids, in my neighborhood, at my work, in my community, in my gym. Your kingdom come on earth, now, here, as it is there. Jeremiah says, pray for the shalom, for the prosperity of the wicked place in which you live. Because when Daniel did that, they recognized it was him. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did that, they recognized it was them. When Joseph did that in prison, the book of Genesis, they recognized the blessing came from those whom they had marginalized. And we may not get the raise or the promotion or the corner office, but may they see light, and may they taste salt, and may they sense something's different because we are there. And it's in that context of Babylon that Jeremiah says this. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for you, for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. Now get this, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. We put that on our bumper stickers. We put that on our t-shirts. We put that on our coffee cups. But it's written to people in Babylon. It's not like on somebody's high school graduation plaque that they got from like Babylon U. You're going to go great and God's going to love you. Now all that's true and still give it to somebody that graduates next May. That's great. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that promise, it's written to people that can't see the promise. The promise is getting to people that they live out their mission in the place where they're at. They'll discover the purpose that God has for them. The promise is to people that pray and keep on praying, ask and keep on asking, seek and keep on seeking. Then they find. The promise is to you and I who live in a Babylon that when we look outside the front doors, there's destruction, there's dismay, there's corruption. And God says, don't hide, but go. Don't be silent, but speak. Don't be obnoxious, but don't hide. And we will live out his plan in the world in which we live, and they will see light and they will see peace. And he says, pray that shalom comes. Exiles in Babylon.
We hope you enjoyed this message today. Don't miss out on next week's teaching. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and keep up to date with what's happening at palmvalleychurch.com.